Major support for Out to Lunch is provided by the law firm of Jones Walker, established in 1937 with over 375 attorneys in offices throughout the U.S., providing a comprehensive range of services to a local, national, and international client base. JonesWalker.com. And by Hancock Whitney, with more than 120 years of experience helping clients protect the financial future they deserve, even in these challenging times. Hancock Whitney, your dream, our mission. And by Shorten Associates, legal recruiters in Louisiana and Texas.
Welcome to this special edition of Out to Lunch Louisiana. I'm Peter Ricciuti in New Orleans.
I'm Christian Mader in Lafayette.
And in Baton Rouge, I'm Stephanie Regal. Normally, we're the hosts of Out to Lunch in our respective cities. But during the course of the current public health crisis, we're joining forces from our respective home studios to bring you a statewide look at what's happening in the world of business and finance.
Some businesses in Louisiana are beginning to open, but restaurant dining rooms are still closed. In Lafayette, when the French Press reopens, we'll go back to hosting Out to Lunch there. Until then, they're doing curbside takeout, and you can get the regular French Press menu items or a family dinner delivered through Waiter or Grubhub and directly from the restaurant, 337-233-9449.
In New Orleans, the restaurant that normally hosts Out to Lunch, Commander's Palace, is closed, but their wine cellar is open for pickup or Orleans Parish delivery with over 35,000 bottles for sale. Find out more at commanderspalace.com.
Here in Baton Rouge, Mansur's on the Boulevard is open for pickup and delivery. You can order by calling them at 225-923-3366.
Whenever we get into any kind of real serious financial trouble like the recession of 2008 or the economic slowdown we're in now, we're confident the world is not coming to an end. The reason we're so certain that the financial system is not going to crash is because we believe the Fed is not going to let it. The Federal Reserve is a central bank of the United States. It's actually a series of 12 Federal Reserve banks. Here in Louisiana, we're in the Federal Reserve 6th District. It's anchored by the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. The vice president and regional executive of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta is Adrian Slack. Adrian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
I want to start by taking you back to a statement the chairman of the Fed, Jerome Powell, made on April 9th. He said the Fed will provide up to $2.3 trillion in loans to support the economy. This funding will assist households and employers of all sizes and bolster the ability of state and local governments to deliver critical services during the coronavirus pandemic. In other words, on April 9th, the Fed gave the United States $2.3 trillion. Now, the Fed is not actually printing money, but on April 9th, it did, in fact, create $2.3 trillion that didn't exist on April 8th. Can you explain how that works?
Well, that's, in a sense, the beauty of being the central bank. So there are a couple of ways that this happens today. As you mentioned, we're not necessarily printing money. Where would you store that much money, for example? A lot of that happens digitally today. So as the Fed, there are a number of programs that we have rolled out since the pandemic, and we are being backed or funding those in a couple of ways. So some of those instruments that we are using to support the credit markets, and what you're referring to specifically is municipalities, some of those things are have the backing of the Treasury. So the Treasury is actually providing the equity there and is the backstop for the Fed. Other instruments that we have, that money's created digitally. So when we decide, for example, that the economy needs us to support it through additional monetary policy measures, we can provide currency and inject that into the system to make that available to ensure that, in this case, the plumbing of the financial system of the U.S. is flowing correctly. But it is the magic of being the central bank in some sense. It's not unique to the Fed. It's something. It's the purpose of a central bank, one of the purposes.
And you want to look at the tools you have on hand. You have You've got moving of interest rates, the reserve requirements. Are they all being implemented now?
Yes. So we began with the interest rates as you started. One of the things we learned after the financial crisis is that moving boldly and quickly would be a very effective measure in another downturn. So we have taken those lessons and exercised that here. So interest rates are near zero. In addition to that, we took a number of the lending facility tools that we utilized after the financial crisis and also stood them up within a number of weeks. Since that time, we have, as you mentioned earlier, entered the world of supporting municipalities, supporting the corporate financial markets in a larger way. We are involved with the PPP and the Main Street Lending Program that resulted from the CARES Act. So some of the things we have the power to do independently, and some of them we are doing at the instruction of Congress in combination with the Treasury.
Adrienne, this is Stephanie. At what point would the Fed reach their limit, if that doesn't sound too stupid a question? I mean, is $2.3 trillion is a lot. How much more assistance can it go before things get really out of whack?
So $2.3 trillion is a lot. And I mentioned the Treasury earlier. And so some of the lending we are doing, again, has the Treasury's equity as that backstop. And we're a long way from reaching the end of what the Treasury has from an equity perspective. The Fed is prepared to do what we need to do and use the extent of the tools in our toolbox to support this crisis, which is essentially a health crisis that is impacting the economy because of the measures that we're taking to respond to the health crisis.
So you mentioned that interest rates are near zero. They've been pretty low for a long time. And I mean, that even before the pandemic, this was something that, like I said, become a matter of political dispute. The President of the United States even put pressure on this. I mean, it does sort of raise this question. If the economy can function this well at low interest rates, why do we even bother raising them?
So the financial crisis in 2008 was very severe, and we needed to drop interest rates to the levels that they were dropped even at that time, close to zero, to ensure that we were providing an environment where the economy could grow, where businesses could borrow to build and to employ workers, for example. That money that we injected at that period of time, part of why interest rates have remained low and have not increased like you would think they would, is because a lot of that that money went into banks to help build their capital. So if you think about it from the aspect of the money we put in the system is meant to generate business. In this particular case, what happened after the financial crisis is a lot of that money went into the bank's balance sheet. And as a result, banks today are in a very stable position going into this crisis and have the ability to lend in this crisis because of that. So is there a risk that interest rates could increase from that activity? Yes, we're a far way from that, and we are committed to keeping interest rates low to support the economy recovering from this event for as long as they need to be. And then at some point, we will respond with interest rates moving in the other direction to ensure the economy doesn't overheat. So your question of why do we bother, at some point, you need to encourage economic activity, and at some points, you need to really pull back the reins on that economic activity so you don't overheat the economy and get into an unhealthy environment.
And that's one of the things you keep hearing in the financial press now, is that these actions are certainly necessary, they're helpful, but will it lead to a lot of inflation down the road, which we haven't seen for years? What do you think?
Well, again, I'll never say never, but certainly we are a long way from that at the moment. We'll take the price of oil, for example. There is a very much downward pressure on the price of oil today, stemming from a number of things, but too much supply, basic economics, is generating a lot of that downward pressure. For interest rates to increase and accelerate, you really have to have, if you think about where we were prior to this crisis, we were in a very healthy place. We had close to full employment, I think, by a lot of people's measures. There was still some work to do. The banks were healthy. The economy was growing. And interest rates were pretty well anchored, not quite at our 2% target, but close to it. And this being a health crisis causing an economic crisis, you know, I again, I'll never say never that they're not going to spike up, but we well handled and managed that process after the financial crisis, and I have every confidence we will manage coming out of this one in the same manner and use our power of monetary policy to increase interest rates to prevent that from coming when the time is right. We are nowhere near the time being right at this point.
Adrian Slack is Vice President and Regional Executive of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Adrian, thank you so much for joining us today on Out to Lunch Louisiana.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to a special edition of Out to Lunch Louisiana with Peter Ricchiuti in New Orleans, Stephanie Riegel in Baton Rouge, and I'm Christian Mader in Lafayette. You know, nothing sums up the strange and unprecedented economic times we're living in more than what's happening in the oil industry. Maybe there's a fiction writer somewhere who imagined the day oil would become a worthless commodity that you had to pay someone to haul away like garbage. But I doubt there is an economist on earth who saw that day coming, or even the days we're living in now, where we're discussing what's called $20 oil, that is, oil that sells for $20 a barrel. The problem is Louisiana's independent oil producers need $37 a barrel to break even, according to the Louisiana Oil and Gas Association. They're warning that $20 oil could kill off the energy business in Louisiana if prices stay that low for long, and things weren't going so well for the industry going into the pandemic. Keep in mind that the reason this matters is that the energy industry in Louisiana directly employs 30,000 people and supports thousands of other jobs in adjacent industries. Altogether, that accounts for $2 billion in annual state taxes. So whatever happens to the oil business in Louisiana affects us all. So what exactly is happening today in the Louisiana oil business? Well, Gifford Briggs is the guy who gets to answer that question. Gifford is the president of the Louisiana Oil and Gas Association. Gifford, the oil industry has always been boom or bust. Things were slumped a little before the pandemic, and there didn't seem to be any good reason to believe a boom was on the other side of it. So it looks like we're going to need a more robust survival strategy than, well, let's wait for better times to come around. You've pushed for some near-term relief based on long-term policy goals for the industry, lower taxes, cutting environmental regulations, ending coastal lawsuits, but the scale of this problem is immense, so long as commerce is depressed and the baseline outlook wasn't so great either. Beyond the legislative agenda, what is the industry going to do to stay afloat?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that the oil and gas industry is doing the same thing that any other business would do when you see the value of your product, you know, drop by over 80%, and that you start looking at ways to cut cost and tighten your belt. And then you begin looking at you know, essential employees and workforce. And is there an opportunity here to, you know, eliminate some positions and maintain key personnel? You know, the reality when prices are as low as they are, we're producing less. We're certainly not investing in drilling new wells. See, the challenge we have is that, you know, if prices rebound and we let everyone go, you know, we're going to need that workforce back. And oftentimes, you know, people go into other, you lose key people or they go into other industries and you can't get them back. And so our focus as an association, you know, representing the industry is try to figure out what we can do, what policies we can put in place to sort of provide a bridge in the short term under these crazy times to be able to get us so that we are prepared to help move Louisiana forward once we come out on the other side.
Yeah, I'm curious about that workforce component. I mean, you know, I think broadly speaking, not just in the oil industry, you know, any sort of manufacturing business that requires some blue collar labor, I mean, we're seeing them rely less and less on workforce. I mean, is this not still sort of part of an existing trajectory, right? Where we're expecting that, you know, producers are going to get, like you said, more efficient, and that can often mean smaller payrolls, even in decent times.
Well, I mean, look, our industry is no different than that. I mean, we're producing, or, you know, prior to COVID, we were producing more oil than just about ever in our history. And we were doing it with fewer rigs than we've used before because of advancements in technology and horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing. Many times while we have less rigs, the number of people that are involved on a particular project That number hasn't necessarily gone down. So while it's fewer rigs, it's the same number of people that are working. And so, you know, yes, we're getting more efficient. We're using technology, but most of the time that technology is resulting in, you know, we didn't really have to worry about horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing in the 1980s. We just drilled traditional vertical wells. And so there's a whole new service component that goes along with these massively expensive horizontal wells that we're doing to produce all of the shale out in West Texas and in the Haynesville here in Louisiana.
Gifford, this is Peter. In the oil field, you often hear the expression, the best cure for low oil prices is low oil prices. Is that still true? Is there a good case scenario going forward?
Well, you know, normally what happens when you have low oil prices is you have low gasoline prices. The economy starts booming because people take advantage of cheap energy, and cheap energy is great for an economy. I mean, just generally across the board, you know, when you've got cheap energy prices that, you know, families are out there driving, they're traveling, everything becomes less expensive. There's more money in pockets. You know, the challenge for Louisiana is it's just a little bit of the reverse because of the impact that the industry has. So normally low prices drive demand up. The challenge is now is that we have low prices and gasoline's $1, you know, 50 or 89 cents in some places. And that's great. You can car up, but then it just sits in your driveway because you're stuck at home. You're not able to travel. The cruise ships are parked. The planes are parked. And so the things that people would normally do in response to low energy prices, they're not allowed to happen. And so we don't see that the prices moving in the right direction like we normally would because of increased demand with low cost fuel.
Gifford, this is Stephanie. And, you know, we especially in Baton Rouge, a lot of the growth over the past 5 years in the industrial construction sector has been fueled by low natural gas prices. And low natural gas was such an attractive feedstock because of, you know, proportionate to oil prices, it was so much lower. But now the oil is so low, there's not that much demand for natural gas. Am I wrong? And what does it do to that whole piece of this pie, you know, this puzzle?
Yeah, so that's a great point. And we're seeing that reflect in our LNG industry. Multiple projects that were planned for construction have been put on pause or pulled down entirely because the spread between oil and gas is not high enough. And, you know, when you know, there's an 8-to-1 energy content. So a barrel of oil has, you know, 8 times as much energy as an MCF of gas. And so you typically over time see a large spread there to make sense. Well, when you can get, you know, oil for $23, then, you may not want to have to pay the cost for importing LNG and converting that over. So it makes oil globally a better product and provides more energy and more opportunity than natural gas does at these prices. And so, you know, we need oil to go back up to $35, $40, $45, $50 and keep natural gas around $2 so that we have an opportunity for a thriving LNG industry. And again, I mean, I don't know when we're going to get back there. I guess at some point in time we will. But
so Gifford, this is Christian again. We've heard some economic analysts, right, who they look at the widespread, there's no better word for it, you know, economic devastation out there, and they say, well, you know, we're not sure that this is going to sustain for the long term, meaning that they expect maybe later in the year things will right size because people will start buying things again, right? When you guys are looking at the arc from here on out, say the toward the end of the year, is the expectation that consumption will remain really low such that the supply problem continues to be the primary issue? Or are you guys expecting that those economists might be right and we'll see something of a quicker spring back?
It's hard to predict just because we have no idea what we're looking at. I mean, we put, you know, hundreds of millions of barrels of oil into storage. And we have a ton of refined product in storage. And so it's going to take us a while, you know, to eat through, you know, what we've stored up. And I think the real question is going to be are people going to get out and start driving? Sure. Are they going to get on a cruise ship? Are they going to be ready to go to Disney and in a park with, you know, thousands of other people? And so that's the question about how fast does consumer confidence come back at that level? And it almost feels like it's probably going to get there around October or November, which is when everyone is also predicting the second wave of, you know, COVID-19 or COVID-20 or whatever it'll be called to come in. And so I guess the question is going to be is how fast does it recover? How fast does everyone feel comfortable returning to their pre-COVID life? And then, you know, are we prepared, cure or vaccine or whatever we need to weather the next, you know, flu season or corona season, whatever it is, because, you know, if we get all the way to October and it's building up great, but then people start getting sick again and we have this same reaction again globally, then it's just going to be maybe that we're in for a much longer term cycle before people really feel confident returning to their lives, getting on planes, you know, taking their grandparents on a cruise of their lifetime. And, you know, those are the things, the markers that I'm looking at to say, when is it going to come back? And my wife's a travel agent, so we're living it on a daily basis and seeing where people's comfort level is right now.
Gifford Briggs is president of the Louisiana Oil and Gas Association. Gifford, thank you so much for joining us on Out to Lunch Louisiana.
Thank you all. Thank you very much.
You're listening to a special edition of Out to Lunch Louisiana with Christian Mader in Lafayette, Peter Ricchiuti in New Orleans, and I'm Stephanie Regal in Baton Rouge. No matter which part of the state you live in, you've survived disasters from catastrophic downturns in the oil business to biblical floods and storms. One of the most cataclysmic of these in our lifetime was Hurricane Katrina. New Orleans was brought to its knees in a way that, till it happened, had only existed as a theoretical worst-case scenario. Beyond the threat to life itself, hardship like that and the crisis we're going through now creates enormous suffering. It also creates heroes. After Katrina, one of those New Orleans heroes was Blake Haney. Blake is the owner of a business called Dirty Coast. Dirty Coast makes hip t-shirts with a New Orleans flavor. After Katrina, they also made a sticker that said, "Be a New Orleanian wherever you are." Dirty Coast was then a small store, but demand was so great for those stickers, Blake gave away around 1 million of them. And the reason I'm bringing this up is that the slogan united a far-flung diaspora of New Orleanians and captured the resilience that directly led to the rebuilding of the city. Today, Dirty Coast has 4 outlets and a significant e-commerce component. Blake still runs the company. He's also the co-founder of Locally.com, a nationwide e-commerce site that drives consumers to brick and mortar stores, and Bayou Brands, an e-commerce and product development consultancy. Blake, there are very few thought leaders who have actually been on the front lines of rebuilding a shattered economy. You're one of them. What lessons did you learn last time that we can apply right now to rebuild the local, state, and even national economy?
There's a real parallel, I think, right now, even though what we're dealing with right now is completely unprecedented. And it's this sort of need to hustle and figure out where you can find work and who you can potentially help. And if that means you're able to make a few bucks, then great. So I think that my experience with Katrina prepared me to some degree for the current one, but now it's the sort of Katrina, it's a global Katrina that where no one can leave their home, which is a completely new experience for, I think, everyone, literally the entire world.
Looking forward, I mean, what would you say to other, you know, entrepreneurs, startups, to anybody, right, that has a good idea or a company? What can they do? How can they find those opportunities to help others and also to make a buck?
Now is actually the time where you're going to see an enormous amount of entrepreneurial growth and new companies and new projects, new tools being developed. So in that sense, it's exciting, but it is always terrible to have something catastrophic have to occur for new things to rise out of it.
Blake, with what's happened in the pandemic, obviously online sales have gained against bricks and mortar. If you were meeting with somebody with a new idea, would you advise them to have any bricks and mortar?
Yeah, the brick and mortar thing is worrisome in looking into the future. We actually, within Locally, we developed a new tool called Sync Locally that we launched a few weeks ago that is an app that connects between our Locally platform where we pull in and organize and know what's in stock in the physical stores and can then push that dynamically to Shopify so someone can have an e-commerce site up fairly quickly, which I think is now a complete necessity, if anything, to be able to power curbside pickup. Because you can still have a store which you can treat like a warehouse so someone can buy something online, come by and pick it up or do free local delivery. Because free local delivery and curbside pickup is one of the only things out there that's faster than prime shipping. So the ability to use your physical store as a warehouse, as a means to get products in front of people in 30 minutes to an hour, I think is a benefit and advantage that retailers who have physical stores have right now. But would I personally right now drop $7,000 on a really expensive rent in the French Quarter? Probably not.
Blake, I'm curious, you know, something that you just said, but you kind of looking at how small retailers generally have tight margins, right? And one of the things that I've read recently is, you know, the idea that really the conditions of the pandemic are favorable, let's say, relatively speaking, to larger retailers. And the idea being that we could see a lot of consolidation and a lot of mom and pops and stuff. I mean, do you really feel like e-commerce is something that's enough of a lifeline for small businesses to survive beyond that? Or do you think that, you know, consumer habits really are just going to go back to...
There's definitely going to be a, once again, using the word solidarity with what I experienced with Katrina, there will be a lot of people who want to shop local, who know that if they don't shop local, they're not supporting the person who lives down the street from them, who owns that store. They're not supporting local businesses. They're not bringing in local taxes. So my hope is that in New Orleans specifically, or just nationally, this effort that, you know, some large businesses like Visa and stuff, Small Business Saturday, becomes a call across the country for you to support your local businesses, your main street. And once people can start leaving the house and feel comfortable leaving the house, and they can kind of break away from this sort of everyday Amazon type addiction that I think is just, you know, obviously if you look at the stock prices amplified, you know, greatly across the country, people will start supporting more of their local businesses. And every local business has to have some digital presence, must have a website or something, some means for you to be able to be messaged, to take an order for pickup. I think you've probably seen half the restaurants in New Orleans step up their curbside and local pickup game. And so I think that's just going to be the new normal.
Blake Haney is the owner of Dirty Coast and Bayou Brands and co-founder of Locally.com. Blake, thanks again for joining us today on Out to Lunch Louisiana.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining us on this special edition of Out to Lunch Louisiana. We've edited the conversations to fit into the time slot here on your NPR station. You can hear longer versions of these conversations wherever you normally get your Out to Lunch podcast. If you're not an Out to Lunch podcast subscriber, search for Out to Lunch, Out to Lunch Baton Rouge, or Out to Lunch Acadiana on your podcast app. The producer of our show is Grant Morris. Our technical producer is Eric Merle. And photos from this show on our website and social media are taken by Jill LaFleur. I'm Peter Ricciuti in New Orleans.
I'm Christian Mader in Lafayette.
And I'm Stephanie Regal in Baton Rouge. If you're in an essential industry or you're able to return to work, remember to take care of yourself. If you're not going to work, stay home and stay safe. We'll see you back here next week for more Out to Lunch Louisiana.
Major support for Out to Lunch is provided by the law firm of Jones Walker, established in 1937 with over 375 attorneys in offices throughout the U.S., providing a comprehensive range of services to a local, national, and international client base. JonesWalker.com. And by Hancock Whitney, with more than 120 years of experience helping clients protect the financial future they deserve, even in these challenging times. Hancock Whitney, your dream, our mission. And by Shorten Associates, legal recruiters in Louisiana and Texas. Mitchell Foreman wrote and performs all the music on Out to Lunch. You can hear Mitchell's music anywhere great jazz is sold or streamed, and at MitchellForeman.com.
We all make mistakes in life. Si tu avais manqué la dernière Franco mix, c'est okay. Tu peux m'écouter this Thursday at 9 p.m. seulement sur KRVS 88.7 avec Drake Benoit LeBlanc. Et c'est formidable.
It's every kid's dream that if somehow you set the stage, mom and dad will get back together and everything will be perfect, right? Right? Well, on the next Snap Judgment, The Parent Trap. Snap Judgment, storytelling with the beat. Do not miss it.
Coming up tonight at 10 on KRVS. This is KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
And welcome to Bayou DeBelt.